This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole formed an affiliation with University of Chicago earlier this year, and now the two institutions have announced a new award program, the Frank R. Lilly Innovation Research Awards, to honor and support novel collaborative research. Just up the street at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, construction in recent years has rearranged traditional departments, again, to foster collaboration between scientists with different expertise. So what is scientific collaboration, and why is it so important? Those are the big questions on the table for our fall Director's Chair episode of Living Lab. Joining me today is Dr. Joan Ruderman, President and Director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Also, Dr. Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Happy Columbus Day, and welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Bill Karp, Science and Research Director at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, had planned to join us to talk about efforts to increase collaboration between government scientists, their academic colleagues, and the fishermen whose livelihoods are impacted by their work. Unfortunately, though, he's still on furlough, along with thousands of other government scientists, including four Nobel Prize winners. Later this hour, we'll talk about the many ways that scientific research has been impacted by 6 months of sequester cuts and the 2 weeks of government shutdown still ongoing. But first, collaboration. Susan Avery, it is rare in this day and age to see a scientific paper come out, a scientific study, any sort of discovery that has one person's name on it. It's always multiple people. So is all science at this point collaborative? What is different about collaborative research from simply having multiple people working on one research project?
Okay, thank you. There is certainly a growing interest and a growing need to do more collaborative work. And you're right, it could be collaborative work in the sense of just scientists getting together doing their own thing, or really scientists getting together to tackle a problem or a question that requires scientific advancement, that really requires a person in one discipline to be able to work very closely with a person and another person in order to find the solution. So there's collaborations that you will see and growing, and particularly in the ocean sciences. The ocean is a very integrated system. It's biology, it's chemistry, it's physics, it's geology, all interact with one another. And many of the problems in ocean science do cross disciplines. So to investigate those problems, you might get a biologist, a physicist, and a chemist together. So you get things like biogeochemistry, or looking at this problem, or biophysical coupling in a model that, for example, study harmful algal blooms, or bioeconomic model. All of these require these very different disciplines coming together. That said, I don't want to give the impression that all research is interdisciplinary or requires collaborative practice. There's an awful lot that we do not know about the ocean and its processes that would require a very disciplinary focused approach as well. So it's melding the two together and having both of those perspectives.
So typically when we're talking about collaboration, though, we tend to be thinking between different disciplines or different groups, different fields. The collaborative spirit is something that's really always defined the Marine Biological Laboratory. It's kind of been a point of pride. But in that case, the research has mostly been in the field of biology. So are we still talking about collaboration between different fields within biology? And why is that so important to the advancements that have been made at the Marine Biological Laboratory?
So collaboration in the biological sciences in general has always brought together scientists from very different backgrounds with very different expertises, with very different pieces of equipment that are designed to answer new questions in novel technological ways. I'd like to emphasize that most scientists are actually highly social, engaging, and fun people, and that's part of the scientific
They're not
enterprise.
Necessarily the antisocial stereotypes that make it out into the public.
That's absolutely correct. They enjoy working together with other people. They enjoy discussing their ideas about everything, not just science, with other people. The MBL is a very collaborative institution, as you note. We have three parts to the institution. There is the year-round program, which has about 300 individuals, about half of whom are scientists. And then in the summer, we swell several fold. We have advanced courses that are taught by faculty who come from around the world and students who come from around the world, from, I think, up to 40 different countries this past summer. And then we have a visiting scientist program, which brings in about 130 faculty from other different institutions. All of these individuals are in a very small footprint in the village of Woods Hole. And just by bumping into people at the market, at the bar, eating your lunch outside, you hear new things that make you think about things in different ways that you had never thought about before.
I mean, we, of course, are in the midst of Nobel Prize season, and the MBL has some enormous number of Nobel Prize winners to its name in some way or another. Do you think that collaborative spirit is responsible for that incredible track record?
Well, part of it. I mean, the MBL was, since its founding in 1888, was a center for a crucible for American biology. People came from all over the country to teach courses and to do work here. Thomas Hunt Morgan, who won the first Nobel Prize in 1934 in the area of genetics, came every summer for 50 years, first from Columbia University, then he came across the country from Caltech. And he didn't come because he worked on marine organisms. He brought his fruit flies, which were the material he used for his genetic studies, because it was the place where the best biologists would get together summer after summer. And that tradition has continued to today.
And do most of those summer visitors maintain any sort of year-round collaborations, or is it really just that those relationships are happening? It's almost like summer flings in the science.
Yes, it's been called summer camp for scientists. We try not to spin it that way, especially in the time of government sequestration and shutdown. But it is just, it's a lively, engaging place. Many of our summer scientists continue year-round collaborations with people at the MBL who are on the resident staff. So, for example, we have a professor from Dartmouth, Amy Gladfelter, who's working with another scientist from Harvard University, Harvard Medical School, Chris Field, who's working with two year-round investigators on a special kind of microscopy that can detect the orientation of single molecules in living cells. So this makes use of some of the most advanced microscopes that have been developed at the MBL with investigators who come from outside the MBL to study a particular biological question.
Now, Susan Avery, do you think there are certain fields that are particularly amenable to or particularly need collaboration? Or, I mean, you were mentioning, you know, the scope of the ocean. Do you think oceanography is one area where collaboration is particularly needed? Or is this something that is equally applicable across all of the sciences?
Well, I do think that increasingly it's applicable across most of the sciences, but I think the environment in general, whether it's looking at land processes, whether it's looking at the atmosphere or the ocean, you are looking at integrated planetary systems in many ways. And so the environment does lend itself to the need for addressing collaborative projects and getting scientists together to study some of these questions. You cannot really study the climate system without having all of these three components, land, atmosphere, ocean together, and of course the physics, chemistry, and biology. And I should have mentioned also how humans are interfacing with that system as well. It's all very critical. So that's not to say that, as Joan alludes to, that biology in and of itself has many different dimensions to it that are collaborative. Likewise, I'm sure there's many examples in chemistry and physics per se. And part of it also for collaboration gets to the very real that a lot of our facilities for observing, a lot of our facilities for modeling and simulation, for discovery, really are quite expensive. And so you really have to form this collaborative environment, primarily just from a fiscal point of view, in order to capitalize on these expensive facilities in the broadest extent possible.
Now, collaborations can take many forms, as we're going to continue to explore this hour. While doing an internship with WCAI, Allison Satake visited a local company, Hydroid, and learned how collaboration with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is central to that company's success.
Inside this white warehouse, bright yellow torpedo-shaped robots lay splayed out, revealing circuit boards and wires. Engineers on laptops quietly build, program, and test these underwater robots that can survey some of the most dangerous places in the ocean.
And they're being used in the Persian Gulf.
That's Chris Von Alt, president of Hydroid, the Cape Cod-based company that manufactures the Remote Environmental Monitoring Units, or REMUS, autonomous underwater vehicles.
And rather than have 30 men swimming along a beach in the middle of the night looking for mines, you can have one robot going up and down the beach and doing a much more effective job and getting people out of harm's way, which is what they're for.
The company that makes these robots, Hydroid, has about 100 employees now and is expanding rapidly. It's already outgrown its new building that's set to open next year. But it all began with just six engineers at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
We were all pretty much the same age. Everybody had a bunch of kids. And we were working at Woods Hole, and there was the big problem of how you were going to get your kids to college. And there really weren't a lot of answers at the time. So we said, well, Jesus, if we push this hard and we go somewhere, maybe we can create a company. And maybe if we make a company, we can make enough money so that we can afford to pay our kids to go to school.
The engineers developed the REMUS technology, but the formation of the company took several years. Von Alt and his colleagues launched it in 2001.
I think there were probably 18 kids in total or something like that, you know, so it was a big deal. It meant a lot to everybody, but I think it was more of a dream that could happen than anything else.
In 2008, Norwegian company Kongsberg Maritime bought Hydroid. It kept the founders on board and the doors open for business at Hydroid's headquarters in the Upper Cape village of Pocasset.
Hydroid is a big success and REMUS is a big success, but I don't think any of us really thought when we started off that it was going to do as well as it did.
Earlier this year, Hydroid got the green light from the Navy to begin building more autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs. Hydroid outbid big defense companies and won this contract with SPAWAR, the U.S. Navy's Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command. If the Navy is satisfied with the products and has the funding, the project could grow into a multi-year contract, earning Hydroid up to $75 million. Today, Hydroid engineers are building and testing three bright yellow cylindrical robots with fins called REMUS 600s for the Navy. The unmanned vehicles can descend 1,800 feet deep and are equipped with sonar, Wi-Fi, and GPS. Hydroid continues to work closely with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, or HUI, on the research and development of the AUVs. Mike Purcell is a principal engineer at HUI.
And usually what's happened is that HUI has built the first two or three of each of these vehicles and then sort of gotten the bugs out, gone out to sea and tested the vehicles, make sure they work for the first time, you know, the first time. And then the drawings and the technology is transferred to Hydroid, where they're built as a product for you know, multiple users around the world.
While Von Alt was still working at HUI, he hired Purcell in 1991.
There was a need to manufacture multiple vehicles, and HUI is not set up to do that. So Hydroid, the company, was started to provide that service to a lot of different customers that were interested in having vehicles.
But Purcell's group is also providing a service for Hydroid. Von Alt says meeting the day-to-day demands of customers can easily suck up all of your time, leaving no time for the tinkering and creative thinking necessary to stay at the cutting edge.
As time goes on, if you just let the technology stagnate, then your competitors will come up against you or people will lose interest in your product. So it's very important to be able to have an association with a group of people who are thinking that way and looking in those directions, but are also very practical in what they can achieve so that in the end you get a product that's going to work in the ocean. And that's what Woods Hole is really, really good at, besides all the science they do.
Hydroid was one of the first companies to spin off from the Oceanographic. The two continue to fine-tune the relationship to ensure that it's mutually beneficial. Meanwhile, Hydroid's success has other engineers contemplating the possibilities for their technologies. For WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station, I'm Allison Satake in Woods Hole.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, we should say that since completing this story, Allison Satake has joined the communications team at HUI. At that point, she did that story. She was doing an internship here at WCAI. But, you know, we hear in that story, Susan Avery, a number. There's the Navy. There's this private company. There's Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a private nonprofit organization. And the collaboration there is almost more about being in those different sectors and the different financial and time demands of being in those different sectors, as much as the different expertise that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's correct. And it was actually a very nice story that illustrated sort of the nice synergy of creative creating things and getting it into the marketplace and how that feeds back and forth in terms of generation of new economics and new tools that can be used for multiple purposes. So the Woods Hole Oceanographic has certainly had long history of collaborations with the Navy. In fact, it has in many ways, shortly after it was founded by the Rockefellers Foundation, had a large relationship with the Navy on acoustics and underwater physical oceanography. So, you know, there's been a strong relationship with Navy in the development of technologies, development acoustics, operations for obviously submarine navigation and other battle space environment needs. And over the years, of course, there's been this development of these brand new technologies, autonomous underwater vehicles, remotely occupied or operated vehicles. And, you know, it's an interesting dilemma, and Hydroid is one of our successes. We've had at this point now about 14 spin-off companies and would like to obviously even do more as well. And you see what the Navy can do very well, of course, as it has an operational mission. But with an organization, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which is an independent thought that's focused on some of the fundamental research, the development of new tools and technologies, it has sort of a different mission that interfaces nicely with helping the Navy with their mission. Likewise, when you spin off by these technologies, and you heard Chris Von Alt speaking and Mike Purcell speaking, you see the interplay continuing between the sort of the fundamental research tool development, the new ideas versus what can be actually translated into operational and product development on a manufacturing scale. I think that this has led us, in particular, a lot of us, in seeing how the fundamental research organizations like MBL and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, who are out there at the cutting edge and thinking about these problems and working through those, almost are pre-adapted to being able to respond to things that happen. So that happened basically in the Deepwater Horizon and our response there. Fukushima is another example of how all of these things come together, all these different entities with these different sorts of missions that actually can come together. They're almost pre-adapted to be able to respond. So that has been one of the reasons why, in particular, is one example of fostering even in a much more disciplined and creative way these collaborations that we've formed, this newly new center for marine robotics, which is really trying to capitalize on collaborations with other academic institutions who have a lot to do in robotics field, but not necessarily in the marine world. Okay, they've done robotics with manufacturing or biomedical, and with the for-profit sector, so oil and gas companies, defense companies, and other robotics industries, as well as the government.
All right, we'll talk more after a short break. I've got Dr. Joan Ruderman and Dr. Susan Avery here. Stay with us.
I was sailing along, and I thought that I would sail out to the bellbuoy and turn around and sail back.
That's Nantucketer Helen Wilson Sherman.
Sailing back was a little difficult because the waves were quite high. Well, much to my astonishment, four dolphin, gray dolphin, two on either side of me, started to come in the harbor entrance with me in the channel, and no one was there to see it. They followed me all the way into Brant Point, and then I turned to come into towards the Wharf Rat Club, and the dolphins were leaping in the channel trying to find a way out. I guess they finally did, but that was an experience because they were about as long as my little boat.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You've heard of the Piazza San Marco in Venice. Well, one way to see it is from the deck of a cruise ship. Luxury liners sail right into Venice, and they're causing damage. It's a trade-off now between tourist dollars and crumbling foundations.
But like everything in Italy, it's very, very long discussion, but urgent for Venice.
That and the news on the world.
Join us for the world tonight at 8 here on WCAI.
Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm joined this hour by Dr. Susan Avery of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Dr. Joan Ruderman of the Marine Biological Laboratory. We're talking about scientific collaboration, why it's so important, what research organizations can do to foster collaboration. Now, before the break, we were talking a little bit about collaborations between kind of the different sectors in our economy, essentially, between government and academic scientists and the private sector and companies, and how, you know, technology spinoffs collaborations with the government, how those kind of work and how they all benefit each other. And Joan Ruderman, the MBL, even with the biological research that's going on there, often collaborates with the government and with some of the defense segments of the government.
Now, you might not think that marine organisms would have a lot to give to the Department of Defense, but then you'll remember that squid and cuttlefish and other organisms like that are really experts in camouflage. They can settle down onto a background and change to merge in with that background within less than a second. This ability has been developed over millions and millions of years. So the Department of Defense, of course, would like to know how that works, and could that be translated into something that would have been used to the military. So Roger Hanlon at the MBL, working along with scientists at the University of California at Irvine, have been studying the neurobiology and the mechanisms of how cuttlefish, kind of squid, can undergo these camouflage changes. So they have learned a lot. Their funding for this project comes from the Department of Defense. And so they are, of course, severely impacted by sequestration and the government shutdown going forward. And you can talk about that a little bit later.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. But I wonder, you know, in all of these cases where we're talking about research that perhaps is of interest to the armed forces, or research that can be spun off into a private company, the benefit to the government and to those companies is clear. But what is the benefit to the private research organizations, to HUI, to MBL, when your researchers are involved in these relationships?
I think one of the things that you do, what is the benefit, is that you can tackle different types of questions when you collaborate, much more comprehensive, much more challenging, much more societally relevant questions although I like to think of all research as being society relevant, there are others that probably much more complex, let's say, complex questions. And that's exciting to some scientists. It's exciting to be able to tackle a major question that brings all of these people together and that will have some visibility other than in a journal publication and being translated into use, into application. Collaborations not only open up those sorts of things, they open up new discoveries that you wouldn't have. We're collaborating with our scientists and engineers to go down to some of the deepest parts of the ocean to discover new things that we would never discover before. Those are exciting opportunities, new discoveries that come up. And actually, new funding opportunities come and arise because of this. And in this day and age, having a much more diverse funding portfolio is so critical.
Absolutely. So now, Joan Ruderman, the MBL has formed this new affiliation with the University of Chicago, and you've just announced the Frank R. Lilly Innovation Research Awards. Why do you feel that it's necessary to have a set of awards specifically dedicated to fostering collaboration? Why don't these collaborations just kind of come up organically in and of themselves?
Well, scientists are always looking for new opportunities for funding, and anything that's designated as a collaborative grant requires scientists, by definition, to have a team that consists of people from other institutions and other backgrounds, so that it's much more likely to produce novel and highly impactful research. So the Lilly Awards, there will be two pairs of two of them going over the next several years. What they do is they're designed to assemble new teams focusing on new research questions that none of the team members have worked on before. So it really takes people outside of what they're doing right now and forces them to identify a new, possibly what we call blue sky kind of problem that could only be solved by assembling a group of people who hadn't worked together before. The second thing is, which is good for Woods Hole and good for the MBL in particular, is that a part of this work must be done at the MBL by the assembled team. And the work will go over 2 years in an initial period. And the ultimate goal is to get a research product that is designed to allow people to then go forward and secure more stable funding from outside funding agencies.
So it's almost kind of dangling a carrot to get people to think about the collaborations that they could take on if they had the resources available.
That's correct. And it's also a form of seed funding. It's very difficult to get seed funding for new kinds of projects if you don't have a track record and say, I have created this product, I have publication in this area, I'm a known commodity. Federal funding agencies, foundations like to fund people who have a history in a particular area. So seed funding is particularly valuable when you want to start something new from scratch.
Now, it would seem that it's not just a matter of money that's necessary to foster these collaborations. Over the past few years, as Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has built some new laboratories, they've been built specifically to break down some of the designed to break down some of the traditional departmental boundaries. So as you were mentioning early, that's not just biology or chemistry or geology, that you can smush those all together and get this biogeochemistry entity. And so you guys have actually built a laboratory that physically puts researchers from those different traditional departments all into one building. So some of it is just, I guess, the physical opportunity to be in contact with each other also.
Yes, and as was alluded to before, scientists are social animals. They do like to interact, but sometimes, if they're not in the same building, just this idea of walking down the street is not necessarily there. So, basically, back in 2005, the Watson Laboratory that we have on the Quissett campus was specifically built to encourage this connectedness and interaction. Prior to it, prior to its construction, microbiologists, geochemists, and geologists were spread out in very different buildings and on different campuses, some down in the village here, some down in the Quissett. And we needed to do something to really enhance the opportunities for that day-to-day, constant sort of interdisciplinary interaction to stimulate work in this leading area. Our more recent building, the Laboratory for Ocean Sensors and Observing Systems, which is a new LEED gold certified building, was dedicated last year. And that is looking at incorporating all of the various science and engineering activities that begin to define the future of how we actually observe the ocean. So things like the Ocean Observatories Initiative, which is this deployed network of observing platforms and sensors that we're building right now. The Martha's Vineyard Coastal Observatory, which is a cabled observatory off of Martha's Vineyard. The National Ocean Bottom Seismograph Instrument Pool. The Environmental Sample Processor. All of these new technologies and things looking at very interdisciplinary observing systems. And there's interaction not in collaboration, not only in science, there's also international need for collaboration when you're building tools, building networks, putting different sensors and platforms all together.
Yeah, obviously, if you've put up that much money into one physical instrument or piece of equipment, then getting as many different people to use that as possible is just making the best use of your money.
Yeah. And I think just as another point, it's not only do we do this with the buildings, but also we have some constructs like the Innovation Fund that Joan was just mentioning in terms of our ocean institutes. These are institutes that were created to actually foster this collaborative environment in key areas like the ocean and its role in climate. That's a very interdisciplinary topic. And likewise, coastal issues, looking at the plethora of coastal issues that we're tackling, that the huge amounts of population that we have along the coastal area. Conservation science is another area requiring a lot of interdisciplinary work, as well as discovery rather on the frontiers. So all of these things, and there's seed money associated with those ocean institutes to, again, help stimulate that types of collaboration.
So I'm curious, you've talked about the benefits of collaboration and the innovations that can come from it. And that would seem to be a very compelling argument for funding collaborative research. And yet you're saying that there's actually, your institutions have had to create these internal funds because it's actually very difficult to get federal funding for collaboration. What's the obstacle there, do you think, in terms of actually getting funding for these collaborative projects?
Well, federal funding does recognize very strongly the value of collaborations. So, in fact, most scientists I know and the biological scientists have a collaborator or more on most of their projects. People bring different techniques, graduate students go back and forth between institutions. People share reagents and animals that they're working with. So the federal I don't want to give the impression that it's only seed funding that recognizes the value of collaboration. In fact, every grant application that has a collaborator is strengthened by that. What seed funding does in collaboration is create new opportunities where people didn't have a history of working in a particular field. So, you know, at the MBL, for example, we give out research awards to visiting scientists who come mostly in the summer, but they can come at other times during the year. And we have about $300,000 of those to give to visiting scientists every year. It would cost, say, an individual faculty member about $10,000 to $20,000 to $30,000 to spend a summer with his or her research team at the MBL. So we had a team that consisted, for example, of scientists from the University of Texas Austin, Jennifer Morgan. She's now a full-time scientist at the MBL. Joe Buxbaum, who came from Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and Ona Bloom from the Feinstein Institute of Medical Research. And they all gathered at the MBL in the summers to work on spinal cord regeneration in the sea lamprey. Now, many people may not know that that aquatic organisms, and in particular marine organisms, have this vast potential to regenerate many body parts. And the sea lamprey in particular, you can sever its spinal cord just at the level of what would be the neck in us. And it's unable to swim. And then over the period of 5 to 6 weeks, the spinal cord regenerates. And by 7 weeks, the sea lamprey is swimming without a limp, as one of my colleagues would say.
Right. Yeah, we've actually, spoken with Jennifer Morgan about her lampreys here on Living Lab before. In addition, I spoke a few months ago with some Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution researchers, Tracy Mincer, who's been using the vast diversity of microbes in the ocean to try to find cures for or at least treatments for cystic fibrosis, and Max Saito, who's this very serendipitous collaboration has arisen where, again, marine microbes and the diversity of habitats that they've adapted to in the ocean is helping figure out Lyme disease. I mean, so sometimes these collaborations are really kind of far out things that you and in both cases they said, well, really that collaboration coming about was just completely serendipitous, that they don't think you could even have created an environment where those would necessarily have come about and created it deliberately, that it was just complete serendipity.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And you mentioned Tracy Mincer's work on cystic fibrosis. That's exactly one of those serendipitous collaborations that came about. But, Tracy does study the small chemicals that marine microbes make and to do specific jobs such as communicating with each other or warding off predatory protozoa. And it was the Flatley Discovery Laboratory that came to us. They're located in Charleston, Massachusetts, and worked with us and talked to us about this idea. And eventually awarded Tracy a grant to provide the thousands of chemicals for screening for potential drugs to treat cystic fibrosis and look what might be valuable substances and what might be very promising. So, this whole marine microbe world and all the microbes, this exciting world that we don't see has such tremendous potential and, they produce such opportunities for us to discover and they've never been studied before. And when you have somebody like the Flatley Discovery Lab that's there to help push that, it can be quite exciting.
Dr. Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Also with me, Dr. Joan Ruderman, President and Director of MBL. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us.
By far the worst thing is seasickness. I'm definitely a seasick sailor. That's sort of an oxymoron.
Ordinary seaman Brett Bluestein of the HUI research vessel, NOR.
So you start to get sweaty, and then you get cold sweats. And at the point where your mouth starts to water, that's when you know you have to hit the head. It takes about 3 days to get used to it if I haven't sailed for a while. It's absolutely the worst torture. And the worst thing about it is everyone has their job on a ship, and no one's going to fill in for you. You know, there are no extras, so you have to do your work when you're sick. But on this ship is 100 feet bigger than the ship that I started on. I'm much less apt to get seasick, so that's great. The other ship's like a cork. You roll a lot from the left to the right, and front and back and everything else.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
The worst thing about seasickness is you know you're not going to die.
Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests are Dr. Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Dr. Joan Ruderman, President and Director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. We'd planned to also have Dr. Bill Karp, Science and Research Director at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, with us. Alas, he and thousands of other government scientists are still on furlough. It's been 2 weeks since the government entered a partial shutdown. So, Susan Avery and Joan Ruderman, I want to turn our attention to the impacts that government spending cuts are having on science. And of course, we can't forget our attention right now has been focused very heavily on the shutdown that's been going on for 2 weeks. But we're at about the six-month mark for the sequester cuts that took effect earlier this year. And Susan Avery, when we spoke around 6 months ago, around the start of the sequester, you were fairly optimistic that Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and other academic institutions would be able to weather these cuts as long as they didn't go on too long, you know, that you could make it through this and still in pretty good shape. Are you still feeling optimistic about the financial situation funding science?
No. you know, everyone's focused on the shutdown, as you said, but the shutdown only further compounds the more real serious threat of this ongoing decline in federally sponsored R&D budgets, as well as sequestration. The federal R&D investment today is at its lowest point since 2002. And it's been particularly corrosive effect on ocean science, where the investment as a percentage of GDP has been reduced by half since its high point in the 1980s. And, you know, this is really disturbing because we're at a point here where our enhanced knowledge about the ocean and the ocean as the planet's flywheel drives our climate and weather in many systems. And you look at consider the economic consequences of not capitalizing on increasing our knowledge base and observing the ocean. Last year alone, I think we had 11 major weather and climate disasters costing more than $1 billion each, including, of course, hurricanes, floods, droughts, heat waves, wildfires. Sandy was in there, and more than $110 billion in damages. Coincidentally, that's about the same amount that the federal discretionary budget was reduced due to sequestration. So, you know, there's economic factors playing here in a changing environment and a changing ocean where science is going to be critical in order for us to make wise decisions about how we can do, and particularly looking at what is happening in changing ocean and our marine ecosystems, the impacts on commercial and recreational fisheries, related industries, coral reef system impacts, and the list goes on. So I think the real threat, the shutdown just compounds the real threat of a declining R&D and sequestration.
Now, Joan Ruderman, are we starting to see these impacts here in Woods Hole at MBL? Are you starting to feel the impacts of the sequester and of the shutdown?
Yes, we are. So about half of the MBL's budget comes from federal grants, and much of that comes from National Institutes of Health and the other part from the National Science Foundation. So we're seeing it in many ways. One is we have reduced payouts to our scientific projects, which you might think maybe a 5 or 10% cut is not very much, but that money also helps run the institution, and it means that many institutional factors cannot be supported at similar levels. So instead of it just being flat, you start to see kind of a downward spiral in things. So I think it's really important to point out that, you know, federally funded biological research, in addition to environmental research, you know, improves human health, it improves innovation, it has spillover into jobs, areas like healthcare, pharmaceutical industry, and it changes the next generation of scientists, and it keeps the U.S. competitive. And when young scientists who are in the system see that older scientists or even themselves are having trouble getting sustainable levels of funding, they're much less likely to continue on as research scientists. The graduate students and undergraduates that they teach see discouragement and challenges and difficulties in previously well-funded and very highly successful scientists getting funding, and they're much less likely to want to go into a biological research career or an environmental sciences research career. So even though you may think it's just a 5 or 10% cut and we're all used to belt tightening, it has follow-on effects that are very damaging. I wouldn't even say potentially damaging. We're seeing this already. Graduate students who might go on to become faculty members and carry out independent research programs are considering other careers.
And now, I saw one survey recently, a Huffington Post article, saying that that something like 20%, one in five American scientists, was considering a move overseas because of sequester cuts and funding uncertainties. Now, we've heard in the past few days that because of the shutdown, research stations in Antarctica have had to go into caretaker mode. Essentially, you know, this is obviously the coming into summer in the Antarctic right now, the research season. And basically that whole season of research has been canceled. And there's actually a grad student from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution who made the long trip down there on an icebreaker, spent, I think, something like 5 days basically hanging out on the icebreaker while they put the station into caretaker mode, and then is having to make that trip home without doing any of his research. So how much is that Antarctic shutdown, Susan Avery, impacting research at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution?
Well, you cite first, obviously, the very real and immediate concern about this graduate student, his work, career, his thesis. This was a research opportunity that was going to get the bulk of the data for his thesis. And obviously, when you go to the Antarctica, and the stations down there, both Palmer and South Pole, things are scheduled very, very tightly. There's a lot of scientists that have to get down there. There's lots of logistics that have to be done. And the moment you have a glitch in that schedule, it's very, very difficult to make it up. And most likely will be very challenging to find another opportunity for this student to get there. Obviously, we will try. And then there's the idea that a lot of the work down there is basically long-term observational records that have been in there for creating a long database for many, many decades. And once you lose data, you're not going to be able, in an environment, you're not going to get it back. You can't recreate.
You've broken the chain.
You've broken the chain. You know, the environment is not going to exactly be the same as before. So you're constantly are losing some very, very important data in these long-term records. So, you know, much of that loss of the field season data and gap in the data is really critical when you're studying long-term trends, such as what you're doing in Antarctica. You know, elimination of these research cruises, the interruption of this graduate student's work, these are all lead to, as Joan alluded to, these early career scientists that could be quite discouraged about a research career. So that's just one thing that transpires. There's other impacts, of course, as well.
Now, Joan Ruderman, are we seeing a similar impact in the Arctic as we are to the Antarctic research?
Not quite yet, but the MBL also has a team that would have been in place in the Antarctic. Linda Emerald Zettler and a faculty member from Brown University have a project that has been going on for some time that are looking at the impacts of global warming on bacteria that form the base of the food chain in the Western Antarctic Peninsula, which is one of the most rapidly warming areas of the world. And they are looking at which microbes are there and how climate change is affecting them. So as Susan said, a shutdown is completely breaking the chain for them. They will not have not be able to get data for a long-term observational study. So it is a huge impact, negative impact on their work.
It's not just something you can go back in 2 weeks and make up. I mean, this is the whole season that's lost, and you're never going to be able to recreate that data.
That's right. It's like being away for a year and missing your baby. Mm-hmm. Growing up for that first year, or from 2 to 3 or 3 to 4. You can't get it back. In the Arctic, we're holding our breath on that. Most of our scientists go up there during the summer season.
Yeah.
So we're keeping our fingers crossed that things will be resolved
in time for that to still go ahead. Now, I spoke a few days ago with one of the 4 or 5 employees of the National Oceanographic and Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration down the street here in Woods Hole. And he's the person who keeps the boats, essentially the research vessels, in working order. And, you know, he said basically that they're just sitting at the dock. They're not doing any of the research that they would normally be doing. And in fact, it's not clear that those research cruises and that research, as we've been talking about, will be made up. He said it's a matter of if, not when. Susan Avery, are we seeing any impacts on the boats, the research vessels that HUI maintains and operates. I mean, those are federally owned and funded, but operated by the Oceanographic, and that's kind of the model for most of the research vessels in the country. So are we going to start to see impacts on that whole system?
We'll see some. I mean, for the most part, the UNALS, the university research fleet, which is operated, in fact, by funding from primarily from the National Science Foundation, but also from NOAA and Office of Naval Research, is as long as we have what you have to do to be able to fund these things is to be able to make connections with the business systems at these agencies in order to download the money. Okay, so if you have money in the bank, these things, and you have grants that have already been approved and in force, you should not be in problem. If you can't access those business systems, like we can't at NSF right now, you have the money for a certain period of time, and now what in order to continue funding these projects, you have to basically have a line of credit for your institution and borrow against that line of credit in order to fund these things, realizing that you will eventually be reimbursed. There are sometimes, though, when that's not going to happen, and you just have to cut something. So,
well, and do we know that you will be reimbursed when the shutdown is over?
If there's existing grants and contracts, or certainly from the NSF and the NIH and ONR, most of these agencies, that's the case. The problem exists more dramatically when you may not be, you might be in a more of a contractual relationship with definite tasks or work orders, and essentially like what we have with the Ocean Observatory Initiative. We're in the deployment phase of this in this major observatory, and we only have work orders approved to a certain date, okay? And if we work beyond that date or spend money beyond that date without approval from the prime contractor or the client in the case of NSF, then we have to stop work. Now, stopping work when you're in the middle of deploying a major oceanographic observing system can be devastating. It has that long-term consequences as well, because you have to lay off a lot of contract staff. You don't know if you'll be able to get those contract staff back. Come on, you have this gap in putting things together and deploying things, and that we require once you start, the startup costs afterwards are significant when you lose that continuity.
Now, Joan Ruderman, one of the strengths of MBL, or one of the signature, initiatives of MBL is all the courses that you run that have educated a phenomenal percentage of the scientists that are out there today. And you were saying that one of your most high-profile courses, the microscopy course, has already been impacted by the shutdown.
So we offer advanced courses, mostly for graduate students, postdoctoral fellows, and even faculty take those courses. I took one myself 5 years ago. This past few weeks, we've been offering a course, Optical Imaging Technologies. This is a very large course. One of the co-directors is a scientist from the NIH. A lot of the advanced microscopy vendors bring in their equipment, including their newly developed stuff that is under beta testing. And we have students from all over the country, some from all over the world, come to take it. Several of the people teaching in this course are actually NIH scientists, so they were unable to come. Several of the people taking the course were from the NIH, so they were unable to come as well. So that created an immediate and very negative effect on one of the most advanced and sought-after courses that we have.
Now, we were talking earlier about the importance of collaboration and the benefits of collaboration. But of course, when the government funding disappears and when government scientists disappears, you potentially have a real gap. So I want to ask you both, with the few minutes that we have left here, is collaborative science stronger for having all of these different parts in place when you start to get a lapse in government funding? Or is collaborative research because it always is drawing on, potentially drawing on government scientists working with your academic scientists, does that create a weak link?
Well, I think collaborative research is resilient. You're basically asking is it resilient in many ways. It's resilient if you have multiple funding sources. And you have teams that can continue to work when you have little glitches. You're right. In many ways, the loss of interaction with our federal government scientists can be quite devastating, as it is, particularly if it becomes a long-term lack of ability to engage with each other. So, you know, if the funding is only federal and you still can't have that federal contact, it becomes a lot trickier and a lot less resilient, I would say.
General, would you agree?
Yes. But in the long run, it's really not clear if collaborative research is going to be more or less vulnerable. I think research in general will decline and eventually grind to a halt in certain areas of biological research and certain areas that that the Woods Hole Oceanographic is engaged in. So there is some resiliency when you have multiple funders, multiple collaborators, some who come from university institutions who may have access to other sort of restricted funds that are not present. You know, at the MBL, half of our support comes from foundations as well. Foundations can be approached to help out. I know that the University of Chicago, with which we are now an affiliate, has, you know, on the day that the shutdown was announced, called to say that they would help us out with any short-term cash shortfalls that were occurring from NSF.
So do you think that we could see, as a result of the sequester and this shutdown and the contraction of government funding, a reorganization of how science is funded and how essentially the scientific community is structured going forward?
You know, R&D still is, in my mind, a public value and a public good. And it is something that to have a sustained R&D program from the federal government, I think is essential. You cannot have an R&D investment and innovation occurring without that federal government presence. You know, the foundations, private philanthropy, the for-profit sector certainly all can contribute in very meaningful ways. Both in terms of talent as well as in terms of funding resources. But this is a partnership, okay? This is not transferring one responsibility from that is primarily a federal responsibility to something else.
Dr. Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Dr. Joan Ruderman, President and Director of the Marine Biological Laboratory, thank you both.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.